For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. In about 5 months' time, Professor Anne Kelso will step away from the role of CEO of the National Health and Medical Research Council, a position she has held since 2015. The NHMRC has just announced a new approach to gender equity in the granting of research funds, which will start to bear fruit in October of next year when successful applications are announced. We invited Professor Kelso to have a chat with us today about that new program, as well as to reflect on her time as boss of the NHMRC and what might come next. Been an age.
Absolutely. We talked very soon after I started.
Yeah, 2015 it must have been. As you said, when we last talked, you were fresh into the job by a couple of weeks, I think. How's it look now?
Well, I'm looking back on 7.5 years of it now.
Yes, yeah.
And with just 5 months to go before I'll finish my term, I'm not seeking reappointment because I think, you know, there's a right time for these things and really important not to stay too long. I hope by the time I finish, people won't be saying you stayed too long.
Have you achieved the goals that you wanted to achieve back in 2015?
You know, I came into the role not really thinking, you know, people always say, what's your vision? And my feeling was, I understand NHMRC from an outsider's point of view and as an applicant, and I'd been on some committees and I was on council, but I don't actually understand the agency as a thing. And so I spent a bit of time trying to, well, obviously learn about the place and learn about the job, but also just to listen to people and try to understand what the biggest issues were. So it was not like coming in with a big vision where I'm going to fix this, but I did see that we were, the whole funding program was under huge pressure. We then talked a lot internally about how to review that, how to consider the best way to reshape it. And I decided the best thing to do was rather than ask one of the big consultancy firms to do a review for us, that I'd pull together a bunch of terrific people from around the country who are researchers in different ways, different types of institutions, different fields, to talk this through. And so the big thing I did in the first few years was have that expert advisory group, and then they advised us on the redesign of the grant program, and then we had this huge project of redesigning the grant program.
And then, of course, COVID turned up.
Yeah, and, of course, just predictable and unpredictable. I come from the flu world, so I knew pandemics happen, but you can never say when they're going to happen. You don't know how big they're going to be. And so we've just obviously experienced something absolutely huge from a global point of view.
Yes.
It's interesting looking back, you know, would we have disrupted so much of our grant program at that time if we knew we were about to face that disruption? Well, no, probably we wouldn't. The new grant program started in 2019. The first grants started in January 2020.
There you go. Bang.
One of the consequences of that is that it's really hard now, 4 years into the new grant program, to look back and say, well, what's worked and what hasn't worked, because we've had this enormous disruption by COVID. So I think it'll take a bit longer to be able to say, well, you know, what needs adjustment, what's going well.
It has been a huge disruptor of many things. You're an immunologist, I mean, basically, and you come from the vaccine technology world as well, I believe. What have you made of it all? There've been some terrific advances with the mRNA platform, etc. How do you feel personally, rather than from an NHMRC point of view, how do you see the progress we've made in terms of vaccine technology and where we still have to go?
Well, I think it was a fabulous demonstration of what you can achieve in an emergency, and that we all wish you could achieve at such pace in normal times, and it's unrealistic to expect that kind of pace. But I mean, leaving aside the RNA vaccines, which came along and are truly transformative, think about the fact that we had AstraZeneca vaccine produced so soon into the pandemic, and a more conventional vaccine, but an absolutely extraordinary piece of work in a very short time. That meant at every level of that invention and production process, people had to take risks. not knowing whether it would work, not knowing whether the funding would come through, but absolutely driven by the public health need. And it, I just think that was brilliant. So even before we had the thrill of finding out that the Pfizer and then the Moderna mRNA vaccines were actually effective, we already had produced something that worked.
From a grants and research funding point of view, is COVID dominating?
We continue to get requests for funds, and we also have been very flexible in our advice to people who already had funding, that if they wanted to pivot their research towards COVID, you know, there were a lot of virologists, immunologists, epidemiologists already funded, and many of them pivoted their work, and that was completely okay with us. That was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
NHMRC didn't roll out special funding for COVID, but the Medical Research Future Fund did. And so we had a complementary role there. We talked a lot at NHMRC about what to do early in the pandemic, what to do about our grant program. You know, would people be able to do research? Would peer reviewers be available to review grant applications? So we trimmed some things back. We streamlined. We pulled in extra money where we could to provide extra funding, which mainly rolled out in 2021. But mainly what we decided to do was to try to keep things as stable as possible so that people would continue to have a place to go to apply for funding rather than totally disrupt our way of doing things. So we just tried to get a balance of between continuity and a bit of trimming back to reduce the load. A pragmatic rather than an exciting approach, if you like. I think, MRFF really covered off on extra funding for vaccine development and a whole lot of other things, which were very good.
Let's talk about the gender equity situation, because you've just published with the MJA a perspective about what the NHMRC is going to be doing in terms of gender equity for research funding. What's the current situation, and what did you feel needed doing?
Well, this is something that probably when I came into NHMRC, actually, let me step back. When I was first offered the job of CEO of NHMRC, I met with the then Minister for Health, who was Peter Dutton. We forget now all these years on that he was the Minister for Health for some time. And when he met with me, the first question he asked me was, what are you going to do about women? And I was a bit taken aback because it was not top of my agenda. I was not, I was a female researcher, but I was not particularly aware of how bad the data were. And it was only really when I came into NHMRC and saw the data and saw, particularly in our fellowship scheme, how women simply disappeared from the scheme, that I started to see that actually there's a substantial problem here. Warwick Anderson, as CEO before me, had started a number of gender equity initiatives because he was really aware of the problem towards the end of his own tenure. And we continued with those. And in 2017, we started doing something new with our project grant scheme at that time. And that was to give what most people would call near miss funding. So we would go below the funding cutoff with an extra budget to fund some extra grants that were led by women. They were still very highly ranked, highly scored, really excellent applications. So there wasn't a question about their quality. It was simply a way to boost the opportunities for women and to reduce the gap between men and women in that, which was our biggest scheme at the time. So we've continued doing that for several schemes ever since. But it hasn't been enough, and we introduced in the new grant program the investigator grant scheme as a different type of fellowship scheme. It's still a fellowship, but it has a research support package as well. So the overall funding into that scheme is a lot bigger than it was in fellowships because of these packages being part of the deal as well. But it's still a scheme which funds people at every career stage from early postdoctoral all the way through to the most senior professorial people in the country, with five stages there. And so it showed just exactly like the old fellowship scheme, that more women than men applying in the post-PhD years, and then sometime in mid-career, just a few years later, the women are disappearing fast. And by the time you get to the most senior level, you've got about four times more applications coming from men than from women.
I know that there are some quarters of the medical profession who would say, oh, well, that's women's choice. You know, they go off and have babies and they do the family thing. And so why should we treat them? You know, that's their choice. Why do we need to give them help?
Yeah, and I think it's in many cases there may well be people who for very positive reasons, make a change and decide that this is not going to suit the way they want to live their lives. But I think we know from the experience in many professions and in many countries like our own, as well as in Australia, that many women are leaving the sector or leaving the fellowship applicant pool, which is a subset of the sector, because of the uncertainty, the insecurity, because of the ways in which their contributions are not always recognised at the level that their male colleagues are. Fantastic study of that in the US that was published in Nature in August. Huge study. It was about when you correct for all the different parameters and differences, women were still receiving less credit as authors or as inventors on patents than their male colleagues. So I think there's that sort of issue. I think there's also a hidden issue just been coming more in recent years, and that is of harassment, which will tend to be of men versus women, you know, sexual harassment and abuse of various kinds, or the milder sorts of harassment that are belittlement or those sorts of issues. Yeah. We hear more and more now, of course, it's partly because of the Me Too movement, but we hear more and more the stories of women who will leave a lab or will leave a profession because of the environment. Now, I have no idea how large that issue is, but I think it's another one of, it's just one of many factors which are kind of hidden. We know about them. They're really hard to measure, but they all add up to what we have called, and many people would call, systemic disadvantage for women. I think this is a really important factor in the disappearance of women from our senior workforce. And a really important issue here is, you know, many people are saying, and I understand the reasons, surely this is just a matter of time. Look, we've got all these brilliant, energetic young women coming into our research workforce in significant numbers post-PhD, and it's just a matter of time. They'll all appear at the more senior levels a few years down the track, wait 20 or 30 years. Well, we've got really pretty good data back to the year 2000. So that's 22, 23 years. And we've had more women than men applying for fellowships since 2001 every year. So that's 20 years, 21 years of women entering our particular bit of the workforce, larger numbers than men. And that bubble has not come through as a bubble. We've seen it. Very little progress.
I'm chatting today with Professor Anne Kelso, the CEO of the NHMRC, about her years at the top and a new system for improving gender equity in medical research funding. Professor Kelso recently wrote on this topic in the MJA, and you will find the full link to that article in the show notes to this podcast. Don't forget you can find all our previous episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, and you can guarantee you won't miss any upcoming episodes by searching for Medical Journal of Australia at your favourite podcast platform and hitting the subscribe button. Back to our chat.
I think this thing about credit is really interesting. You know, and in the end, we collect anecdotes because it's so hard to get data, but we did have somebody, an academic from a regional university, talked to us at one of our leadership roundtables during our consultation in August. And she talked about the fact that she worked as a researcher in labs in Australia and in the US. And her experience was that her male colleagues at the same stage were asked by the supervisor to write the grants, and she was told to get on and produce the data. And, you know, it's an anecdote, but it's the sort of thing. It means she's the technician and the male colleague who's at exactly the same stage is being given the opportunity to advance as an independent researcher.
Yes.
We have to not make too much of the anecdotes, but they do help to bring home what that means at the level of each person if there are many people having that kind of experience.
Talk to us about the new special measure that the NHMRC is going to bring in next year.
Well, because this is a pipeline effect, and because we don't really have an issue at the early stages of this investigator grant scheme, because that's where women are coming in, they're doing well, But they start to disappear soon after. So we're focusing on the more senior levels of the scheme and have simply made the decision to aim to award equal numbers of grants to men on the one hand and women and non-binary researchers on the other. We did modelling of, if we'd done that in the first 3 years of the scheme, what would the outcomes have been? And of course, you know, it means fewer men get funded, more women get funded. It has very, at least in the modelling, has very little impact on merit, because there's a great bunching of applications of very similar score through peer review that are essentially indistinguishable.
Yes.
And so our modelling showed that if you went further down that distribution to pick up more women, to award more grants to them, you would only reduce the funding cutoff for them by about 0.13 out of 7. So we've got a 7-point scale and we've been going down by 0.13, and the cutoff for men would go up by a similar amount. So you're at the point where actually there's no real difference in quality when you're talking about 0.1 out of a 7-point scale. The merit issue is a minor one here, because that's the other, of course, the other people concern that people raise is, well, you know, now you're funding on gender, not on excellence. Well, from what we understand of the distribution of the scoring, when we look at the first few years of the scheme, this is not going to undermine excellence. We will still be funding absolutely excellent people, but we will be making a relatively small adjustment for that systemic disadvantage that women have experienced and continue to experience.
Yeah. So male grant applications will be competing against other males rather than against women as well.
That's correct. We effectively make two separate competitions.
When will that start happening, Anne?
Well, that's for the scheme that's opening in late January. And it takes a good part of the year for people to put in their applications, then for them to go through peer review, and then for the funding recommendations to be developed and to go through approval and ultimately approval by the minister. So we would expect that probably going to be around October next year that we would be announcing those outcomes.
Why now?
Why wait?
Yes.
I think the only question would be, should we have done it in a staged way where instead of going to equal numbers, you say go to, you know, 75-25 or spread it over 2 or 3 years? That would have been a possibility. When we consulted with the sector, there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm. There was some support, not a lot of enthusiasm for doing it in a staged way. I think, you know, if you look back over more than 20 years of data with very little shift, you think, well, let's get on with it. The sooner we get on with it, the sooner we get the ripple effects that I think are important as well. And I'm really interested to see how this plays out. But the first ripple effect I hope for is that more women will have the confidence to have a go. Our problem at the moment is women aren't applying, so of course they can't get funded.
Yes.
More women who apply, then the more chance they get to have to be funded, you know, based on merit, of course. There's another ripple effect I want to mention too, and a couple of people brought this up with me and I'm really pleased to hear it, and that is that institutions might start to think it's useful to recruit women, not only men, because this is a strategic and a financial decision that institutions make when they decide who to try to recruit and who to provide resources to enable them to succeed.
Yeah.
And I think this sort of step, even though it's just one scheme from one funding agency, it's the sort of step that might make people think, well, actually, female researchers are just as valuable as our male researchers.
Have you had fun?
Look, this job is an extraordinary job. It's a huge privilege to have a job like this because, I mean, clearly I have the chance to influence policy. It's not just my decision. I don't do everything on my own. We have wonderful advice from our council and our committees, and I report to a minister who ultimately makes the decision on everything important. But in a role like this, you have the chance to influence policy about something that you care about. I think the other thing is that having come from an academic background and some engagement in global public health through influenza, I've now worked inside government for a few years, and that gives you a different perspective on the world, and it teaches you something about how the world works that I think is just extremely interesting and useful.
What's next for you, do you think?
Well, I'm not looking for a job. I think the first thing to do is to take a break. I mean, in the meantime, I have several months left to go, and I'm very focused on what I can, how effectively I can use those remaining months.
For sure,
months.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing, and as I get nearer to the end of those months, then I'll be more focused on what's going to be important next. But I hope that my experience is valuable in some way beyond what I've done up till now, but I'm also not in a rush to fill the hours in the day, because there's so many interesting things to do in life and in the world.
I think if the federal government managed to get a national CDC off the ground, I suspect you might be a good candidate.
Well, I don't know, but I'm very interested to see how that develops, because the COVID has told us a lot about our needs as a country and what works and what doesn't work, the fabulous assets we have. And of course, from an NHMRC perspective, we have an extraordinary asset in our research sector. We also clearly have challenges of a federation, and there are many issues that I hope that an Australian CDC would be able to address.
Anything else?
Well, when I think about gender equity, I mean, it's an interesting experience for me, because I will be have left NHMRC by the time that the first round is announced. But I think that at that time, we'll need to think very carefully about what the impact of the initiative is. It'll be important to monitor it very closely. And I will certainly hope that NHMRC will be very transparent about the outcomes, so that everybody can engage in a discussion about how that's going and what the impact has been across the sector. That will be a very important time for us.
I think transparency has been one of the hallmarks of your reign, don't you think? It's been something that seems to have been very important to you.
It has been important to me, and I think it's assisted by the fabulous data team we have here, but also by the development of data technologies, because the work that would have been needed 10, 15 years ago to be able to put out the level of data that we can now would have been really very, very heavy. Of course, it's still a big job, but we're greatly assisted by the fact that we can collect data and analyse data so much more effectively today. So I also, you know, naturally hope that NHMRC will be able to continue to put out a lot of data about what's happening. It gives the sector insight, and I think it helps us develop better policies as well.
Thank you so much for the last 8 years. It's been fabulous to work with the NHMRC during that time, and you've been always so accessible. So I really appreciate that, and I'm sure our listeners do too.
Thanks very much, Kate. It's been good to talk with you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.